Welcome to the Fabulous 413. I'm Monty Belmonte. Kalise Smith is away. Later in the show, the creators of a new documentary about Smith College via South Africa that'll air on NEPM TV tonight. It's called Where I Became, and some of the Smithy filmmakers will join us. U.S. Congressman Jim McGovern on the end of the occupation of his Northampton office, on his face-to-face with the president on St. Patrick's Day, and the over-under on whether the government shuts down this weekend. He's on the way as well. But we'll begin with the 18th annual Fair Housing and Civil Rights Conference. According to the Wayfinders website, the Fair Housing and Civil Rights Conference brings together people who share a commitment to protecting and furthering the rights of all Americans, both regionally and nationwide. The conference provides an opportunity to hear speakers from a wide range of disciplines to discuss the state of fair housing and civil rights in America today and share their ideas on how to effectuate change on both a local and national level. Here to talk about the conference is John Fisher, who's the Fair Housing Coordinator from Wayfinders, our neighbor
right across the street,
parking lot. I was joking with John earlier that I was going to illegally charge my electric car in your parking lot there because I know you have chargers.
Well, it's a real question of which side of the tracks where is the good side and something like that.
Yeah, something like that. I guess we're on the wrong side. And we're also joined by Shondell Diaz, who's the entry coordinator for the three-county continuum of care at Community Action Pioneer Valley based in Greenfield. Shondell leaves Springfield and goes to Franklin County. I leave Franklin County in my electric car and come here to Springfield. The conference is 3 days in April, April 10th, 11th, and 12th. And we usually talk about things a little bit closer to the event. However, this conference is already filling up and almost sold out. Before we get into the nitty-gritty about your different organizations, John, tell us who this conference is geared towards. Who are the type of people that you think should be coming to this conference?
Everyone listening. Basically, what we really try to do in the conference is to bring together people, literally both people, if you will, who are providing services, people who are attorneys, people who feel they've been discriminated against in some way, people who want to know how to do their job the right way. I mean, we're dealing with the concepts of fair housing, civil rights, which is pretty much applies to everybody everywhere. And the whole point of it is to get people who normally don't talk to each other a chance to sit down and be able to really to, if you will, break bread together, go to some very interesting workshops together, and really keep a dialogue going.
And there are a lot of legal folks. It is at Western New England University, which has a legal program there as well. My friend and ACLU attorney, Bill Newman, is one of the presenters who will be part of it. And people who are doing work in the housing and the fair housing field in our area, including Shondell Diaz. Tell us about what the three-county continuum of care at Community Action of Pioneer Valley is.
So the three-county continuum of care promotes and guides a community-wide vision, strategy, and commitment to efforts to prevent and end homelessness. We mobilize funding, improve coordination and integration of mainstream resources and programs targeted to people experiencing homelessness through a housing-first model, and we establish a system-wide data collection and performance measurement practices to ensure successful housing strategies and equitable housing for vulnerable populations.
Tell us what housing-first is as a model, if people aren't familiar with that.
So Housing First is the practice of the importance that having someone in a safe housing situation and then dealing with all their other problems is the way to go.
Yeah, and it's been interesting working with, say, the Food Bank of Western Mass on hunger issues. You see that the issue isn't just hunger. The issue is hunger plus. The issue isn't just homelessness. It's homelessness plus. Why housing first? Why do you think that's an important first?
Because you're in your most vulnerable position when you're unhoused, right? And for whatever reason, because we don't know exactly what the reason is, there's no like key factor for someone becoming homeless or experiencing homelessness, is to address everything that encompasses their issue. And it's not like a one and done, nor is it a one size fits all solution.
Your conference, part of the conference that's happening in early April, reimagining our approach to sheltering people experiencing homelessness. You'll be there with Matthew Doherty, who is a consultant, Tim McCarthy from Craig's Doors, which people may know the name of that, and Nan Sibley from Community Action as well. What are some of the things that you are doing to reimagine what it means to shelter people who are homeless?
So just a side note, I am also a consultant for the National Coalition for the Homeless on this project on a national level.
Okay. So it'd be interesting to hear about how it compares locally and nationally as
Yeah. So the guidance itself is, and recommendations are from people with lived experience of homelessness across the nation. And their lessons learned throughout, you know, COVID-19 pandemic, and it makes it clear that we must create and seize opportunities to transform our approaches to sheltering people experiencing homelessness. And the framework really focuses on the homeless response and our partners and implementing a project to support communities to pursue such transformation. And are now, again, we did this in two different documents. It's more like a pathway. Mm-hmm. And then on the local level, we have a work group comprised of partners from Hamden, Franklin, Hampshire, and Berkshire counties.
The three county continuum.
Yeah,
the
three county continuum. And as well as our sister in Hamden County, you know what I'm saying? And it's just bringing together a group of people that can truly identify the needs of our community and how we're doing things wrong and how we can fix it. And we're also creating an action plan to address all of the issues that we've identified.
What's a major thing that you feel like we are doing wrong, Shondell Diaz from the three county continuum?
I want to say that we need to listen to our people with lived experience, the people that have actually gone through our systems, because they're the experts.
Yeah. But what are they saying that we've done wrong? You know, I think people with a good heart believe that homeless people should have a place to live, whether that means it's a shelter, whether it means it's a right that they have access to fair housing. Regardless, most people of goodwill think that people should be safe in a home somewhere. Mm-hmm. So how are we been doing it wrong, and what are we learning from people with lived experience?
Our approaches. Uh-huh. Some of our approaches just need to be twitched a little bit, fixed a little bit. You know, some people say that a congregate shelter is difficult. It's demoralizing. Mm-hmm. It can, you know, and it all depends on the person who the agency or the provider that's providing that shelter. It's not every shelter, nor is it shelters here in Mass, right?
Right.
But on a whole, this was something that was really brought up. Just the way they are treated, folks are treated, the way that they're demoralized, the way that they're seen as less than. And one thing that the interim housing framework really does take out, you'll hear me saying this a lot, is interim housing. That's taking the negative connotative word shelter out of the equation. Uh-huh. And putting in another word, substituting a different word that gives a little bit more integrity back to folks that are experiencing homelessness.
That's Shondell Diaz, the entry coordinator at the Three County Continuum of Care at Community Action of Pioneer Valley, based in Greenfield. John Fisher is from Wayfinders, who is the host of this conference that's happening April 10th through 12th at Western New England University in Springfield. He's the Fair Housing Coordinator there at Wayfinders. For those who aren't familiar with Wayfinders, tell us about what your overall mission is there.
Well, basically, Wayfinders does a little of everything. We started out as being simply just one of the first areas which really tested out and introduced the Section 8 program as a concept. And we still have a large number of housing subsidies that we oversee as well. But we also develop housing. We work with people who want to develop housing, possibly giving them assistance, possibly working with municipalities. We provide first-time home buyers with training, with support on that. We are where local area where people would go to get assistance with rental assistance for tenants, the so-called RAF program. We provide counseling to tenants on what their rights are, to landlords on what their rights are. We tend to try to work together on things. We also actually have a program where we work with people who are trying to start a business, for example, helping them get loans and helping them to get started on that sort of thing. And really, in some ways, we try to be available to everybody, and either to direct them to something if we don't provide it, or sometimes even work with them to help them get started on setting up various programs. One of our co-sponsors, Massachusetts Fair Housing Center, for example, was one of the co-sponsors of our conference, was an organization which was sort of a spinoff from Wayfinders. Mm-hmm. So we try to be as collaborative as possible, working with municipalities, individuals, landlords, tenants, home buyers, what have you.
And it's located right around the corner from the NEPM studios here in Springfield. But I'm interested in hearing in just a little bit on how Massachusetts is doing, how Western Massachusetts is doing compared to the rest of the country, whether the governor's housing bond bill is having any sort of impact. And we'll hear all about that as well as more from the 18th Annual Fair Housing and Civil Rights Conference, which will happen for 3 days, April 10th through 12th at WENU in Springfield. Mm-hmm. More with John Fisher from Wayfinders and Shondell Diaz from Community Action coming up in just a little bit. You're listening to The Fabulous 413 on 88.5 NEPM. Welcome back to The Fabulous 413. I'm Monty Belmonte. Khalees Smith is away enjoying wonderful music elsewhere. John Fisher is from Wayfinders, and Shondell Diaz is the three-county continuum of care coordinator at Community Action of the Pioneer Valley. And there is a conference happening in April, April 10th through 12th, at Western New England mm-hmm. University in Springfield. It is the 18th Annual Fair Housing and Civil Rights Conference. Fair housing is what we're here to talk about. That's what Shondell is doing, both locally and nationally. In your opinion, first of all, Shondell, how many people are you working with that are experiencing some level of houselessness, homelessness, whatever you'd like to call it, in the three counties that you're working with?
So I will say that something that educates us on how many people are exactly experiencing homelessness is our point in time count that happens every year on the coldest night of the year in January. It is HUD required, right? And this basically gives us a pinpoint by area of how many folks are exactly experiencing homelessness again. And we still haven't a good count, but I can say that roughly at least 600 to 700 people are homeless within the three-county area on any given night.
Are there enough spaces for them? I know Craig's Doors is one of the places we mentioned that's part of this conference. Are there places for them to go every night? Has the migrant crisis made it hard to get into hotels for people? Because I know, you know, say in Greenfield, right off the Rotary there, there's a lot of Haitian migrants that are living there. Is there enough space for these people every night when it's cold?
No. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, it does come down to politics. And we try to respond the best way we can, setting up warming shelters, not necessarily the three-county continuum of care, but the community as a whole. There's an overwhelming response system when things like this happen, when somebody's experiencing homelessness, when there's a shortage of shelters. One plus that I will say is that Craig's Doors has really stepped up to be that front provider, that open door space where even on the coldest nights they have emergency motel funding that is not available to, you know, just for just any reason, again, on those coldest nights, as well as they open up their doors to have people just come in and warm up in Pittsfield ServiceNet at their shelter. They also have a warming time from like 10 p.m. to 8 in the morning where you can come in from the cold and sit down. So again, there's a response. Is there enough room? No.
That's Shondell Diaz, who's working with Community Action. John Fisher from Wayfinders. How is Western Mass doing compared to the state, compared to the nation? And has the governor's bond bill, housing bond bill, had an effect at all yet? Was it $4.1 billion?
Yes. Yeah. I honestly can't tell you this early what the effect is. I hope it will be.
Mm-hmm.
It will be of a great deal of value. It's a huge problem, and it's in some ways we're still living in the shadow of even COVID,
right?
Because the housing costs have gone up. There's fewer rental units available. There are a lot of reasons for that. One of the things about the conference, why we call it Fair Housing and Civil Rights, is it's not just housing. It is, in fact, it's jobs. It's all various pieces of something. I know when we talk about people who are homeless, I think sometimes people think of that as being a particularly limited population. They have, if you will, a stereotype. And at one time or another, in a lot of people's lives, they find that they've been homeless. So that it's, you know, even when you do those kinds of counts, I don't know whether you're going to get all of the, for example, the people who are couch surfing and so forth. It's really a multifaceted problem. I think we are better off here than in some parts of the country. Yes, I think we're fortunate to live in a state where there's at least an attempt made, and there's a real commitment.
So-called right to shelter state,
yes,
which has been in the news a lot lately.
Exactly, exactly. That there's a commitment to do something about it. How well we do it, that's I think we've still got a long ways to go. That's part of what this conference is about. It's a chance for us to talk together, to really try to sit down and perhaps come up with some ideas even there.
It's a limited space left in the conference, April 10th through 12th, Western New England University, presented by Wayfinders, the 18th annual Fair Housing and Civil Rights Conference. And we're here talking with two of the conference participants, John Fisher from Wayfinders and Shondell Diaz from Three County Continuum of Care at Community Action. We've talked about COVID, and from my experience dealing with people who have experienced hunger and food insecurity issues, COVID was an eye-opening moment for people who had been going about their, say, middle-class lives.
Yes.
All of a sudden found themselves potentially without a job or actually without a job and realized, oh, I've always been one paycheck away from experiencing hunger. Maybe my hope was that that would change perspectives on the causes of hunger, the causes of these social inequities. In your experience working in the housing field, have people's opinions changed and realize on what a precipice we dance on how close we all might be to experiencing homelessness? Let's start with you, Shondell.
Well, I will just say with some from I'm going to provide some information that was provided to us from Springfield No One Leaves, Rose Webster Smith. Evictions have surpassed pre-pandemic levels in Massachusetts.
And there was a pause during the pandemic because I think a lot of people realized that we're in an interesting situation. I don't want to call it interesting, a terrible situation.
And in Western Mass in 2023, there was 5,832 eviction cases filed. That tells you something. You know, that tells you that people, again, that one paycheck away.
Right.
And being a person myself with lived experience of homelessness, it just sometimes is so overwhelming, you know, and you just have to, you're struggling. You're just trying to make it by, you know, and with rents skyrocketing, it's what's expected.
What about you, John? Are you hearing differences of opinion when people experience that after the pandemic? Or?
No. And also, I think what happened, I mean, it was interesting because we've now talked to, or had start to consider again, the great flu epidemic that happened right after World War I.
Right.
But I had no idea of that until probably I was in my 30s. I certainly knew World War I was there. Mm-hmm. More people died from the pandemic than died from World War I, but people sort of erased it. And to some extent, there's that. That seems to be happening now, too. People aren't remembering, even though we're still very much living in the effects of it. It's worse and it's harder. It's harder on the landlords, too. They are, the cost of property has gone up. What they have to carry is harder. A lot of them got the feeling that you couldn't evict anybody, not the people who really needed to be evicted.
Right.
Weren't being evicted either. So that the result is they become, if you will, they would say more cautious in who they rent to. But effectively speaking, that means they let stereotypes sometimes come into their way of looking at it and don't do what they would call taking a chance, but in fact would be probably the right decision both morally and actually from a business point of view.
That's John Fisher from Wayfinders. The conference, which is hoping to dispel some of these myths, April 10th through 12th, the 18th annual Fair Housing and Civil Rights Conference at Western New England University. There's still some spaces available, 3 days, all sorts of different strata of interest if this fair housing is something that you're interested in. Shondell, you mentioned that you have lived experience with homelessness. What does it mean to you to be someone now who's helping other people through that?
I am humbled and I am so proud that I'm able to actually be in this position to actually make real change, you know, to suggest and make sure that we're following through on real change, to be the voice of change.
What does it mean to the people that you're working with that you know maybe more than I would say or some other person would about what they're going through?
So it I think that is the aspect that we have a People with Lived Experience Action Board, for starters, right? And that allows us, again, to make sure that our voices are heard as well as their voices are heard, but that they're at decision-making tables.
Yeah.
And it's so important in every aspect of any type of human services work to have People with Lived Experience in that work, in that position.
April 10th through 12th, the 18th Annual Conference on Fair Housing and Civil Rights at Western New England University. Shondell Diaz from Three County Continuum of Care at Community Action Pioneer Valley, and John Fisher, our neighbors right across the parking lot at Wayfinders in Springfield.
Can I just quickly throw one thing in,
sure,
Monty, which also, although we have a few, by all means, we have a few seats available yet, we also have a very few seats for people who can't afford to, this year, we try not to ever have to charge. This year we had to charge, but we do have some scholarships available if people want to contact Wayfinders about that.
And that's the best way, just get in touch with Wayfinders?
Get in touch with Wayfinders.
Thank you so much, John Fisher and Shondell Diaz. Coming up, we'll talk about a documentary that NEPM will be screening tonight with Smithies via South Africa. But up next, Congressman Jim McGovern answering some of your questions on the end of the occupation of his Northampton office and on his face-to-face with the president on St. Patrick's Day. You're listening to The Fabulous 413 on 88.5 NEPM.
Hey, how are you?
Good, and you?
Good. Let me just get by this. I'm going to this thing. Let me just sign. Do you have a second?
Sure.
I just have to sign it. All right. I'm going to the NGA or National what? Roasters? Oh, so which way do I go?
National Guard.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry. Okay. All right. Whatever.
What are you signing into?
All right. No, I have to go to an event with the National Grocers Association.
They don't have like a congressional easy pass for you?
No. Well, I'm in a building and I actually walked into the building for the National Gallery of Art. So NGA.
So, you went to the wrong NGA.
So I'm getting closer. But the good news is it's just right across the street here.
Oh, good.
So let me just walk in. Yeah, so here.
Luckily, everything in D.C. is in walking distance.
Yeah. All right. I'm in the right place. Okay.
Good. Time for our weekly check-in with U.S. Congressman from the 2nd Congressional District of Massachusetts. Down in D.C., going to the National Grocers Association Conference. When we last left our legislator, your office in Northampton was being occupied by Pocky Wieland and other folks calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. I had offered to go visit the protesters in your office to do a segment with them. And then Pocky Wieland sent me an email saying that thanks for the offer, but we have cleared out. We hit a dead end. Then an ever so slight breakthrough, she says. McGovern and we are on the same side. We're simply able to be more out front than he. He graciously joined us this afternoon for a good conversation at Packard's. Tell us what happened with that conversation with the protesters from your office at Packard's right around the corner there in Northampton.
No, I mean, you know, we had a good conversation. But look, my position has been very similar to their position. Maybe, you know, not as strident in some respects, but I mean, I called for a ceasefire early on in this conflict. I was one of the first in Massachusetts and first in New England, one of the first in Congress to call for a ceasefire. I still believe that. I think we need to stop the bombing. We need to be able to get humanitarian aid into the Palestinian people in Gaza at scale. We need the hostages released by Hamas, and we need to get on a pathway for a lasting peace. And I believe that's a two-state solution. I think the issue that they have raised is about, you know, aid to Israel. I gave a speech basically saying that I think all military aid to Israel should be terminated based on U.S. law. And U.S. law is very, very clear that if U.S. humanitarian aid is frustrated from being delivered to people who are suffering and who are vulnerable, then military aid is suspended. That is current U.S. law. And we're trying to get President Biden to invoke that. I do believe that things like the Iron Dome, which I think they don't necessarily believe we should be given to Israel, but I also worry about that Israeli civilians are vulnerable to bombs from Iran, from Hezbollah, from, you know, Hamas, from others as well too. So I mean a defensive mechanism to block incoming missiles, I think, is not a bad idea. I think it's a good idea to protect civilian life in Israel as well. Then the issue is, like, how does this aid come up? But we don't know how it's coming up. Every week it's something different. This week the speaker said we would bring up an Israel-only aid package. He didn't do that. People like me, I know everybody doesn't agree with me on this, but I believe we should help our friends in Ukraine. They are literally out of weapons, out of ammunition. They will be basically out of everything come the end of April. I think Donald Trump has made it very clear that if he's president, everything gets cut off. There's no incentive for Putin to want to be reasonable. It's to negotiate. He's going to hold on until the election. And I don't want to see Ukraine, a sovereign nation, fall to a bully like Putin. So anyway, we had, I thought, a constructive conversation, as we always have had. And you know, we all have different roles. I mean, part of my role is to move the ball in a direction to get closer to where the goal is. I think the people, you know, who protest in my office, and I'd love talking about all these people, you know, have a more kind of absolutist and, you know, clear-cut position. But we had a good conversation, and I value their advice, and we'll agree on some things, and there's some things we won't agree on, but, you know, I will always try to make myself accessible.
Did you pick up their tab at Packard's?
I think I did, yeah.
This kind of ties into what you were just saying, a question we got from Josh Wyman from Montgomery, Mass. He said, I recently learned that Representative McGovern is working on finding loopholes to send weapons to Israel and Ukraine. I don't know if loopholes is the correct word. You can clarify that if you'd like after. My question for him is, could he explain how the U.S. sending more weapons to Israel and Ukraine helps residents of Massachusetts, who are continuing to see rising costs in all aspects, housing, food, healthcare, schools are underfunded, roads are notoriously bad in the state. Josh wants to know how that would help.
Well, I mean, looking for a loophole is kind of a cheap shot. That's not what we're doing. I mean, what we're trying to do is get the Speaker of the House, you know, to schedule a vote on Ukraine, and he won't. So there is a thing called the discharge petition, which right now is basically a hollow shell of a bill that we want to get signatures on to put pressure on the Speaker. If you get a certain amount of signatures, you can then offer a rule to allow somebody to offer an amendment to whatever that amendment may be. And it might be money for Ukraine, and it might be what the Senate passed, money for Ukraine and Israel. But the idea is that there would be a vote. I don't really feel comfortable always saying that our goal should be to deny debate or to deny deliberation on issues like this that people are very much divided on, but I guess some people do. I would just say to Josh, too, I mean, please don't forget that Democrats and Joe Biden passed the biggest infrastructure bill to help roads and bridges and infrastructure in Massachusetts in our history. I guess people forget that, but we did that. And some of that money is being spent in Western Massachusetts right now. And the reason why I think Ukraine is important is because I believe if Ukraine falls, that's not the end of it. And I don't want American forces, I don't want American troops, you know, having to be fighting a war in Europe. I'd rather support the Ukrainians in their effort to defend their own sovereignty against Putin so that it stops right here and now. You know, when I was in Poland a year ago, the president of Poland made it very clear that they believe that they may be next on the list. And they are really, really, really concerned about that. Maybe people in, Montgomery or wherever he's from?
Yeah.
Maybe he's not concerned about that. But if you lived in Poland, if you live in some of these other countries, you are. And, you know, read your history. I don't think Putin is a benevolent man. I don't believe the narrative that it's our fault that Putin decided to invade Ukraine. That just doesn't make any sense to me. But we want this to stop now so that we do not have a wider war, and so that American forces are not being called upon to be involved in a war in Europe. I don't want that, but to walk away from Ukraine, I think, is a tragic mistake.
Another listener question for Congressman Jim McGovern on this, our McGoverning with McGovern segment, comes from a regular questioner and marcher on the food bank, Dr. Dave Gottsagen, who's a pediatrician in Holyoke. He said that he published an op-ed piece in the Daily Hampshire Gazette talking about how Joe Biden is getting hammered by the press. Twice as many Americans strongly agree, he said 46%, that he's too old to be president as they do saying that Trump is too old to be president. The Gazette featured a political cartoon making fun of his age. He goes on to say that he's concluded in his op-ed, would you rather have a well-meaning elderly man with occasional memory lapses in the White House surrounded by an excellent staff, or a vicious and vindictive elderly man who is, according to Dr. Dave, off of his rocker? He wants to know, why aren't leaders in the Democratic Party screaming this from the rafters instead of hiding Biden from the press and making what he calls timid excuses?
Well, Dr. Dave makes a lot of sense, as he always does, on a lot of different topics. I think he's right. You know, these are the candidates. And the choice is very clear. You can vote for Joe Biden, who, by the way, I you know, at the request of the occupiers in my office, I talked to him about Gaza, you know, at the St. Patrick's Day party at the White House. But I assure you, I mean, he is, you know, he is not senile, and he's fully in control of the facts. But the choice is him or a fascist. And I don't use that word lightly. The rhetoric coming out of Donald Trump is scary. I mean, he quotes Hitler when he talks about immigrants, poisoning the blood of our country. He praises Hitler to his former chief of staff, General Kelly. He wrote that in his book. I mean, he uses words like bloodbath. He talks about being a dictator. I mean, everybody needs to understand what is at stake. Joe Biden is not perfect. There are a lot of his policies that I don't agree with. I mean, I also raised the issue that I think his policy on Cuba is awful. People of Cuba are suffering because he will not change Trump's policy on Cuba. We need to change that. But, you know, I would vote for a chair over Donald Trump. I mean, I'm just telling you, we have to protect this country from a wannabe dictator. And I think that is what is at stake. So, yeah, Dr. Dave's right. Maybe we need to figure this out better. I think they're trying to make light of his age and some of his commercials. But to me, you know, Donald Trump is out of his mind.
Speaking with U.S. Congressman Jim McGovern, you mentioned that you had some FaceTime with the president at the St. Patrick's Day gathering at the White House this past Sunday. I saw the picture where all the Kennedys except one looked like they happened to be there. Tell us what happened during that St. Patrick's Day party, and were you able to talk about some of the issues the protesters had about Gaza with the president at that affair? Or is that uncouth to do at a party at the White House?
No, I mean, it probably is uncouth to do, but I did, you know, raise some of these issues with him when I had a chance to talk with him. He was there with the Taoiseach of Ireland, who I think has had a very powerful and thoughtful position on Gaza. I mean, and he, and the Taoiseach also, when they gave a speech, also talked about the need to for a ceasefire and to get humanitarian aid into the Palestinians as soon as possible. But they were standing together, and I said to the Taoiseach, you know, I appreciate your position on Gaza. I appreciate your call for a ceasefire, you know, and I encourage you to continue to pressure our president to follow your lead. And then I said to President Biden, I didn't get into the details of the protest, but I said, look, I'm hearing from my constituents who want an end to this violence now, who want you to be for a ceasefire, who want humanitarian aid to get into Gaza at scale, not airdrops, but, you know, getting the trucks in, getting the medical supplies in now. I mean, people are horrified by what is going on. And he said he understands, and he's continuing to work on these things. And, you know, it wasn't a long, detailed conversation, but I took advantage of my brief interaction with both of them to reinforce what the Irish Taoiseach was, you know, has been advocating and telling the president that, you know, he ought to follow the Taoiseach's lead.
Congress looks like they're going to pass a $1.2 trillion spending package potentially sometime today, racing against the clock for another partial government shutdown that would hit just after midnight Saturday morning. Any thoughts that that's not going to pass? It looks like the can will once again get kicked down the road to keep things running.
Well, as of last night, the text had not been introduced. It has to be introduced for us to be able to vote on it. I'm hoping that'll be today. I mean, this is stupid. We should have done this last year. Mm-hmm. This is not the way we should be funding our government. I mean, these continuing resolutions and minibuses, this is not the way we should do things. But again, I mean, part of the problem is the Speaker of the House has no power. I mean, Kevin McCarthy, when he was trying to become Speaker of the House, 15 rounds later, gave away all his power. So he's really at the mercy of the most extreme elements of the right wing. And I think this Speaker, Johnson, every day he goes to work wondering whether it's his last day. Because he doesn't know what the right wing is going to do. And he's pretty right wing too. They would just as soon shut the government down. That's disruptive. That is not good for our economy, not good for our country. So I'm hoping we can avert it. But again, we're right up to the deadline. And by the way, the Senate has to act too. So there probably will be a small shutdown if we get our work done today or tomorrow over the weekend, awaiting the Senate to take action on this bill, because I'm sure one of the senators will try to delay it. You know, I don't think it's too much to ask, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, that if you're in control, that you run an effective and efficient operation. And that means getting your appropriation bills and budget passed on time, not threatening to shut the lights off every, you know, few months, and just understanding that in divided government, none of us are going to get all that we want. It's going to require some compromise. So we hope that in the next day or two, we avert a partial government shutdown. But as of right now, I have not seen the text.
There was a rare moment of unity on an issue that may be divisive to people when they hear about it, but if you give it a little bit more thought, may not be as divisive potentially. Speaker Mike Johnson, MAGA Mike, a Republican, and the Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries are supporting a wage increase for members of Congress. Senate Majority Leader, a Democrat, Chuck Schumer, blocked it from being included. But according to Politico, Representative Steny Hoyer, who's a Democrat, is saying that if we don't approve a wage increase for members of Congress, that it would only be rich people who run the Congress. What's your take on a wage increase in Congress? And I guess Steny Hoyer's opinion on the whole thing. It's potentially bad optics for many Americans to see that legislators give themselves a raise, but...
Steny Hoyer is right on the merits. I think the last time members of Congress had a wage increase was over a decade ago, more than a decade.
I think I read 2009 in Politico today.
And, you know, when you get elected to Congress, you have to have two places to live and all these other expenses. That kind of falls on deaf ears for people who are struggling just to put food on the table, who live in Massachusetts or anywhere else. So on the merits, Steny is right. I mean, more and more people are going to say, you know what, I'd like to do it, but I really can't afford to do it. I don't think you want a Congress of all millionaires or all billionaires. And I think the reason why we haven't addressed the issue is really because people are afraid of the political fallout. And I get it. Nobody's going to say, oh, I want to give Congress more money and I want them to have a raise. I mean, no one's going to say, I mean, let's be honest with all that's going on. But that doesn't mean that that's appropriate, right? I mean, we have to start understanding that while it's always, you know, fun to beat up on politicians in Washington, if you make it so unattractive for people to serve, including making it, you know, financially difficult for them to serve, you know, you got to get just people who have deep pockets. I don't think that's good for our system.
A little bit of good news before I let you go. The Biden-Harris administration released $1.7 billion in new commitments as part of the White House challenge to end hunger. Hunger is something you and I both talk about ad nauseum, probably, to people. But tell us what that $1.7 billion will mean in ending hunger and what it might mean for your constituents here in Massachusetts.
Yeah, I mean, it's in a whole bunch of areas, but a lot of it is in the area of food is medicine and, you know, and trying to promote better nutrition. And a lot of this involves pledges, not just by government, but by the private sector and by hospitals and healthcare systems. I mean, here's the good news. We did this conference that you were at a year and a half ago, and a lot of things have happened since then, including a lot of interagency discussion about how the federal government could do better in this area in terms of running healthier and better meals for the people who work here. Also about setting priorities and trying to get our medical institutions to start moving in the area of understanding that food insecurity is also a health issue and that they need to be on the front lines on this. So things are happening. Discussions continue to happen. This wasn't a one-and-done conference. I give the president and the vice president, and by the way, the second gentleman, Doug Emhoff, has been really good on this stuff, a lot of credit for sticking with it. And, you know, there's a lot more that will be announced in the next year. They are working, again, not only within government, but within the private sector to try to leverage even more commitments, not only to end hunger, but to promote, you know, healthier and better communities for us all.
U.S. Congressman from the 2nd Congressional District of Massachusetts joins us every week. You can send a question for the congressman like Josh in Montgomery did, like Dr. Dave in Northampton did, by emailing us at thefab413@nepm.org, and I'll ask it on your behalf. Thanks as always, Congressman.
It was great to be with you. Thanks.
Where I Became is the name of a new documentary that will air tonight at 9 on NEPM TV. The film explores the personal journey of a group of Smithies from South Africa who left their home and families to pursue dreams here in Western Mass. And we'll talk to some of the Smithies behind the documentary next. You're listening to The Fabulous 413 on 88.5 NEPM.
The Fabulous 413 podcast is funded by Northeast Solar, helping customers make the switch to solar for savings, energy security, and tax incentives. Learn more at northeast-solar.com.
One of the lecturers told me about this university in the U.S. that was accepting 2 black South African women per year, and that I should definitely apply.
This is an opportunity of a lifetime.
There was a lot of curiosity about, you know, who are these people from South Africa?
I was very much conscious of the fact that I come from a war-torn country. I'm not only doing this for myself, but I'm doing this for my country and for my people.
I met some of the people that I love dearly at Smith.
My mind and my life opened up in ways I hadn't expected.
I think education has given us choice, and that goes across all the beneficiaries of the scholarship.
I make sure that the work that I'm doing really just contributes to society.
Smith is that place where I became.
And Where I Became is the name of a new documentary that was a trailer from that will air tonight at 9 on NEPM TV, filmed in part in South Africa and part here in Western Massachusetts at Smith. The film explores the personal journeys of a group of so-called Smithies, which is a loving term if you haven't heard that before, from South Africa who left their homes and families to pursue their dreams here in the 413. Some of those Smithies join us right now. Jane Dawson Shang is one of the executive producers. We are also joined by an associate producer and sound engineer from the new documentary, Council Brandon, both of whom are also Smithies. And we were hoping to be joined via Johannesburg from your co-executive producer, Jane. Can you introduce us to who unfortunately wasn't, because of technology, able to latch on to this conversation here in Western Mass from Johannesburg today?
Oh, thank you so much for having us. Tandiwe Njobi, my co-producer, dear friend, and co-founder of our film. She's working full-time at Standard Bank. She's been our partner since inception, and they've just had some issues with technology over their load shedding, as they say in South Africa. She sends her best.
Well, she was fantastic in the documentary. She's one of the featured Smithies who came from South Africa to become here in Western Massachusetts. I love the title, Where I Became. Tell us a little bit about what drew you to this story for a documentary, Jane.
Thank you. I am a passionate Smithy myself and was very, very grateful to have been introduced to Tandiwe when my husband and I started a new sector of our career in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually introduced us because he knew as Smithies we would have so much in common, and he was correct. Tandiwe took me under her wing in Joburg and introduced me to the local Smithies there, and we just talked about how Smith meant so much to us. At the time, we didn't even think about the scholarship program. I knew nothing about it. And finally, they said, well, you know, Jane, the scholarship program, we were so lucky. I said, how do I not know about this? I'm not that much older than you all. And that's what we did, the deep dive. And we realized very few people knew about this. So she advised me to go talk to Peter de Villiers, the South African professor at the time of psychology at Smith, who had come from Harvard and was set up to recruit international students. And I thought I was going to have a 15-minute coffee with Peter to hear the story. It was a three-hour discussion with documents, with copies of these students' passports. It was his personal history. And then Tandiwe and I got excited, and she said, I'm going to find the other students. So she launched a search on Facebook. I dove into the archives, and we realized no one knows about this. So that's really what started. That was the fuel.
And you can learn all about it tonight, 9 o'clock, NEPM TV. Where I Became is the name of the documentary. That was Jane Dawson Shang, who's one of the executive producers, associate producer and sound engineer on this documentary. Council Brandon joins us as well. Another Smithy, although from a more recent graduate of Smith. But you were involved in the production of this movie. And Jane mentioned the scholarship program. We're talking about apartheid South Africa. We're talking about Nelson Mandela is still in jail at this point. And many of the folks who are featured in this documentary sort of graduate contemporaneously with the release of Mandela. And a change in the way the apartheid state of South Africa. What drew you to this film, Council?
You know, it was really the mystery of the story and, you know, a Smith history that I just didn't know. I think that was fascinating to me. And I joined really early in 2018, so I got the chance to dive into the Smith archives and look at documents and newspapers and yearbooks. All this visual information that hadn't really been looked at before, you know, since it was probably shoved into a box in the basement of the archives in the 90s. So it was just really exciting to feel like I was unearthing all this information. And working with Jane and Tandiwe was incredibly exciting as well, because they're both Smithies. The network is really strong, and sort of just being able to see how Smith has affected women over generations, over time, just like fostered my love and affection for the school. And yeah, and I studied film at Smith, so it was just sort of like a convergence of all of my interests and career aspirations into one amazing project.
Yes, this documentary could be none more Smith. I will say, I mean, it does feel almost like a Smith marketing video in some ways. It is inspirational and powerful in that way as well. And I'll fully disclose, my wife is a professor at Smith, and I will be speaking at a conference there tomorrow. Period. But this is a fairly fascinating documentary. And Jane, you worked with Tendiwei, as we've mentioned, as an executive producer on this. Let's hear a clip from the documentary in Tendiwei, who was not able to join us, from Johannesburg's own words.
When I came to campus, it was important for me to seek out my community. It wasn't as important for me to seek out the South Africans as it was for me to seek out the Africans. And I think that's just a factor of my experience having grown up in exile and then having gone to school in New Mexico. And then once I'd established myself there, I could then go out and seek new relationships. I knew a lot of people, but I really found that the African Students Network was my support base and my home.
It's unfortunate that we couldn't have any of the actual folks that were featured in the documentary talking with us today, because it really is a powerful story to hear about where they had come from in South Africa, and how stratified it was there racially between white South Africans and black South Africans, and also Indian South Africans, which is featured in the documentary and isn't something I really thought of in that way. But then coming to the United States and then integrating even as roommates in a way that they would never have been able to hear, and finding their voice through the means of education at Smith. What's some of the stories that you've heard, Jane, from Tendiwei about coming to Smith and what it meant to her and going on to her future as she's a very successful banker now?
Monty, what was one of the most exciting things about being connected with all these different scholars is each story was so diverse. Tendiwei actually grew up in exile. Mm. So there were South African stories she didn't know, because her parents were working for the ANC outside, and she really grew up in Zambia, in Lusaka. And then you'll have Thembikile, who's one of the first scholars. She grew up in very, very simple conditions, and she talks about that. And her unique circumstances really were, maybe she had the most hardship, and her parents did not support her going to Smith, but she knew that she had to do it. And then you have Philo, who was her partner, and one of the other first two. And Philo actually grew up in the Indian school system. So what I think we all learned, and me as a non-South African, I learned so much from the difference, the diversity of these scholars. And then they learned from each other, and they brought their different backgrounds to Smith College. And one woman that you might remember, Sipho Kazi, who says, I learned about apartheid when I got to Smith and I see the demonstrators, right? Because she lives in a homeland with black leaders and black educators. Her life was seemingly very different than others. So I found that fascinating.
Council Brandon, in the minute that we have left, what, as somebody who just graduated from Smith a couple of years ago, what inspiration do you take from these women that you got to work with in the production of this documentary that'll air tonight?
I think just the power of, you know, telling your own story and using your voice. I mean, this is something that if Jane and Tendiwei hadn't taken the initiative to make this film, the story might not have been told. And I think that's a huge lesson for me, just, you know, forging ahead and not being afraid to share. Yeah.
Are you excited to see your film on PBS stations? It's not just on NEPM, it's across the country, right?
Yes, nationally, it's super exciting. Yeah.
Do you have a watch party planned or anything?
We should. We actually really should.
Yes, you should. It's not too late. It's happening tonight at 9 o'clock here on NEPM. Council Brandon is an associate producer and sound engineer, and Jane Dawson Chang is one of the executive producers. Where I Became, 9 o'clock tonight on NEPM TV and across the country on PBS stations. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the, I love that dog in the background, by the way. I don't know, what's the dog's name?
It's not mine.
Council, is that your dog?
Yes, I'm so sorry. That's Frankie.
Hi, Frankie. Tomorrow on the Fabulous 413, Jenny Powers, who's the director of science at the Springfield Museums and is the museum's official Swifty, will talk to us about the museum's new planetarium show, Taylor's Version. We'll hear live music from rapper, podcaster, and graphic novelist Tem Blessed, who's playing the Drake in Amherst on Friday, and we'll drink wine in the Wine Thunderdome. I'm Monty Belmonte. We'll see you tomorrow on the Fabulous 413.